My name is Sarah, and I got involved with Vote Save America way back in 2018 when it first launched.
My name is Nancy, and I first got involved in VSA in 2018.
Ever since then, Vote Save America has been the best part of my political engagement. Anytime the election anxiety starts to feel overwhelming, I remind myself that my anxiety relief program donation is fueling grassroots organizations around the country.
And VSA has the Political Action Finder, a handy website I've used to find phone banks, knowing that I'm helping to win critical House seats.
In fact, I already signed up to volunteer with the Political Action Finder on the VSA website and helped replace disgraced former volleyball star George Santos.
So if you're someone who doesn't want to wake up on November 6th this year and regret not doing more, and I'm pretty sure you are, go to votesaveamerica.com to get started, and I'll see you at a phone bank soon.
This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com, and this ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.
Huge news, guys.
Huge news.
Crooked Coffee is here, so we can finally stop talking about how it's coming soon and start talking about how it's arrived. Our first blend, What a Morning, is available in delicious medium and dark roasts.
I'm a dark roast guy.
Medium.
I love them
me.
Both, but I think I'm just a huge fan of this dark roast.
I medium. Want you all to know something, that we had so much coffee come to different people at Crooked so they could all test different kinds of coffee so they could pick out a really good one. They worked very hard to pick out
people
a good one.
People really seriously, too.
A lot of comparisons, a lot of talking about coffee.
We worked hard with coffee experts to make sure our beans are top shelf quality.
The beans are top shelf.
Don't give us any shitty beans over here.
Top shelf beans. You got to get on a step stool to get these beans.
And of course, you know, we're Crooked Media. It was important that the coffee was ethically sourced. And very importantly, we're donating a portion of the proceeds to the organization Register Her, which will help millions of women across the country vote.
There are people out there that said, that a media company couldn't launch its own coffee brand. We're here to say we're going to prove you wrong.
Bezos.
Haters.
Because we got coffee now.
Go to crooked.com/coffee to get your Crooked coffee now.
Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Ben Rhodes, and Tommy is on vacation this week. So it's just me, but on this episode, I'm just going to go through some of the big developments that have taken place around the world the last few days, a lot in politics, in Israeli politics with the collapse of the government there, in the French elections and the Colombian elections, the latest out of Ukraine. And then you will hear my interview, which I taped during my recent trip to Europe with Leonid Volkov. And this is a pretty well-timed interview. Leonid Volkov is Alexei Navalny's chief of staff and has been for a bunch of years and now essentially helps run the Navalny political and media operation, which is largely in exile based in Vilnius. What you'll hear is how the opposition, the Russian opposition, the Navalny operation has managed to prepare for Navalny's imprisonment, how they've been taking direction from Navalny within prison and communicate with him, although, as you'll hear in a bit, that's rapidly changing as we speak, how they've basically built a media operation. They've always had a heavy media component, but what they're really focused on is getting news into Russia about the war. Real news, which is hard to come by for Russians. And they've had some success here. They're reaching tens of millions of people, largely through their YouTube channel. You'll hear about some of the impediments that they face in doing that as Google and YouTube have imposed restrictions on what can be done. Unfortunately, some of those restrictions have caught up the Navalny operation. So you'll hear a bit about that, a bit about how they look at the future of Russia, the vulnerability of Putin, what Russian political opinion might actually be, a bit of skepticism from Volkov about these polls that constantly show sky-high support for Putin and sky-high support for the war in Ukraine. That always kind of made sense to me if I was a Russian and somebody called me up and polled me and said, you know, what do you think about Putin? I might feel a little uncomfortable saying I didn't support him. But this is a great window into Alexei Navalny, into the Russian opposition, an alternative Russian view on the war than we hear from the bombastic statements that come our way. So you'll definitely want to hear this interview. I was pretty fascinated by it to sit down and talk to this guy and hear firsthand what they're trying to do. And it's essential. I mean, we talk about the war in Ukraine and we obviously talk about the support for the Ukrainians. Ultimately, Russia is a country with 140 million people and a bunch of nuclear weapons, it's not going anywhere. And so the only way that we get to a better place, ultimately, in addition to obviously supporting Ukraine in the immediate term, is for there to be some change in Russia in the longer term. And here you hear a voice that at least is fighting for, working for that change. Just a few more things before we get started here. Crooked Coffee is officially here. As you've heard Tommy talk about, it's delicious, so I have to say. The first blend, What a Morning, is available in both medium and dark roast. I'm a dark roast guy, but you can pick up the medium as well. They're both delicious. It's a specialty grade, ethically sourced, small batch roasted to perfection. Plus, Crooked is donating a portion of the proceeds to Register Her to help millions of women across the country vote. So go to crooked.com/coffee to get your Crooked coffee now. We also have exciting news about Mother Country Radicals. This is the new Crooked podcast. In this 10-episode series, host Zayed Ayers Dorn takes us back to the 70s when his parents and their young friends in the Weather Underground declared war on the United States government. I've listened to the beginning of this. This is an awesome podcast. You're not going to want to miss it. Amazing characters and amazing history. Even if you know the history, you don't know the details as told by someone, you know, literally born on the inside. It looks at this kind of monumental time in our history. It uses archival footage, firsthand interviews from nearly every living member of the Weather Underground and the Black Liberation Army. So please check it out. Listen to the first three episodes of Mother Country Radicals right now, wherever you get your podcast. A couple more things, of course, I'll put in my own plug. Please pick up the paperback of After the Fall if you haven't read it already, haven't read it in a different form. You can also get the audiobook, which I narrate. It obviously covers all the stuff we've been talking about on the show, including the time I spent talking to Alexei Navalny before he was in prison. He's a key character in the book, so another reason to pick up After the Fall if you haven't. Also, yesterday was World Refugee Day. It's something to step back and think about. 100 million people around the world who've been forcibly displaced. That's a record for refugees. We haven't seen anything like this since after World War II. So please figure out how you can support refugees or all manner of organizations you can support. One thing I want to plug, if folks are just interested, there are 100 million refugees, and in that number that's so big, sometimes we lose the individual stories of people who are refugees. There's an incredible new project called SADAproject.org. That's SADproject.org. What they do on this website is they tell the individual, very specific, very wrenching, and very human stories of six refugees. So if you want to put a human face on that very big number, go to SADAproject.org. So we're just going to start with some political news from three very different countries where we've had three very dramatic developments over the course of the last several days, each of which I think speaks to trends we've talked about on Pod Save the World a lot. The first is in Israel, where we will have our fifth election in 3 years coming up. The Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, after weeks of some political dysfunction in the country, as the very tenuous coalition that has governed Israel has been collapsing before our eyes, the Prime Minister Naftali Bennett announces that there will be another election later this year. And as a part of this move towards a new election, he announced that his coalition partner, Yair Lapid, is going to take over as Prime Minister on an interim basis until that election. Now, what does this mean? This means that we could be looking at the potential return of Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, the former prime minister, as the leader of a very right-wing, very nationalist coalition. We could have the emergence of Lapid, who's the more moderate member of this coalition, as someone who's not been able to quite get over the hump, take his crack at it. Or you could have Naftali Bennett, also a right-wing nationalist, although one who's broken from Netanyahu. He will make his run for it too, most likely. So this is, once again, a very uncertain moment in Israeli politics, where the kind of deadlock that has been the norm in Israeli politics for the last few years will once again be handed over to Israeli voters to see which way they want to go. Interesting timing in a couple of ways. One is because Joe Biden is scheduled to go to Israel in a few weeks as a part of the trip that will also take him to see non-friend of the pod, Mohammed bin Salman, in Saudi Arabia. So anytime an American president visits Israel, it's obviously a big deal. Visiting Israel in this kind of strange political circumstance, I think, makes the visit even more complicated. There have been reports that the U.S. government has asked Israelis to not undertake particularly provocative actions, whether it relates to settlements, whether it relates to the Palestinians. But when you're in a time of political dysfunction in Israel without a very strong government, you never quite know what's going to happen on the ground. And so I think the context for that visit gets that much more complicated as we look for a resolution, hopefully through the next election, to this Israeli political crisis. It does not lead to the return of Netanyahu, but that unfortunately cannot be ruled out. And so, like many other countries, Israel's political circumstances remain very fragile and very much in question. Now, getting to places that have had elections in the last few days. The first was in France, where we've talked a lot about the parliamentary elections that we're going to follow the presidential election. Now, just to rewind the tape here, Emmanuel Macron, the pretty much centrist president of France, was reelected pretty comfortably over Marine Le Pen, the far-right leader. However, these elections did not go the way that Macron wanted them to go. He did not win the kind of absolute outright majority that he had in his first term and that he would need to govern kind of with ease. He will be able to get a majority cobbled together with some other centrist parties, but he faces a much bigger left-wing bloc that performed pretty well in the election. But he also faces a much bigger far-right bloc than we've ever seen before. Marine Le Pen and her party did better in this parliamentary election than they've ever done before. And so you're going to have something of a polarized legislature in France. You're going to have a president in Emmanuel Macron who's going to have to cut deals to get his domestic agenda through and to sustain support for his foreign policy. And I think importantly, something to watch here, Macron is term limited, so he has a five-year term. But these bigger questions about the future of French politics remain unresolved because you have a disturbingly large block of far-right voters and parliamentarians that will clearly be trying to gear up for that next election. You'll have a left that came together in a big tent coalition for the purposes of standing in this election. And we'll have to see whether that leads into some kind of rejuvenated French left that can reclaim the presidency. And you have Macron's kind of centrist political movement, which is very much tied just to the person of Emmanuel Macron. And you have the question of whether that can lead into some kind of more durable political party that is able to carry forward after Macron. So like a lot of democracies, France remains a place with, albeit a strong president Macron, but a very uncertain political future as well. And then the other election that we've been watching carefully was in Colombia. And in Colombia, you had a very dramatic development with the victory of Gustavo Petro, Colombia's first left-wing president in its history. I think this is really notable in a number of ways. The first is we've talked about several times. This continues a very substantial trend of left-wing leaders getting elected in Latin American democracies. We've seen it in Mexico. We've seen it in Peru. We've seen it in Argentina. We've seen it in Chile. Now we see it in Colombia, which has usually been the kind of strongest right of center country in the region. This is also a country in Colombia that has a very longstanding relationship with the United States, received billions of dollars over the last decade or more from the United States to fight drug cartels, to try to eradicate drugs, to continue the fight against the FARC, which was a left-wing guerrilla movement that turned into a political movement that reached a settlement with the government in the Obama years. So the question here going forward is, what is it going to mean for Latin America and for the United States to have this leftist government, not just in Colombia, but these leftist governments across the region? I think, you know, in a lot of ways, there's something hopeful about this. You have electorates that are really frustrated with inequality, which has been terrible in Latin America, with political elites that are not responsive to the concerns of ordinary people. You have steps that need to be taken against climate change in Latin America. So you have a left-wing agenda that I think could deliver a lot of results for people if real steps are taken, meaningful steps to combat inequality, if real steps are taken to make Latin America a key partner in the global effort against climate change. But you also have the challenge of meeting expectations. Can these leaders who are getting elected in places like Chile and Colombia really deliver on what they've run on? Especially when they're faced with pretty endemic inequality and pretty sclerotic political elites that are pretty out of touch with the people who are turning away from traditional political parties. So this will be fascinating to watch, and it will be fascinating to watch what it means for this U.S.-Colombian relationship to have a left-wing leader like Petro in power in Colombia. I think it's also a sign of just how out of touch America's Latin America policy can be from what the people in Latin America are actually looking for from their own leaders and from partnership with the United States. I think this is on display in Florida, which is kind of the center of right-wing American politics as it relates to Latin America, where Ron DeSantis gave some kind of rant yesterday about Marxist, communist, blah, 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 bad guys taking over in Colombia. You know, Ron DeSantis, I don't think has his finger on the pulse of what the Colombian people are looking for. He has his finger on the pulse of right-wing politics in Florida. Unfortunately, right-wing politics in Florida has been quite influential in making America's Latin American policy over much of the last couple decades. So this is something else to watch, whether Colombia drifts away from its relationship with the United States or whether the United States in the Biden administration can have a more rational Latin America policy that is less rooted in these ideological debates of the past and more focused on, hey, what can we do together to fight inequality, to fight climate change, to support democracy, to combat corruption? So all of this bears watching, but pretty dramatic political developments in three really important and different countries, Israel, France, and Colombia. And each of them really speaks to kind of what we've been talking about a lot on this podcast, which is the future of democracy itself, the collapse of a lot of the traditional political parties that have held power for much of the last several decades, and this question of whether the populist moment that we're living through, whether that manifests itself going forward on the left or on the right. So a lot to keep track of going forward.
Pod Save the World is brought to you by the UN Refugee Agency. The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations, and they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation. That's unrefugees.org/donation.
Now, in Ukraine, several updates on Ukraine before we get to our interview with Alexei Navalny's chief of staff. The fighting on the ground in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine continues to be a grind. And you've seen Russia continue to make kind of incremental gains around some of the more strategically important cities in the region. Tough fighting on the ground, but some of these towns that have been contested are falling more and more into the hands of the Russians, as we talked about in a couple of the previous shows. I think what you see from the Ukrainians is a continued demand, really, for more longer-range artillery and heavier weapons that can allow them to beat back Russian advances in a way that they just haven't been able to date. I think there are also a bunch of interesting developments as it relates to both Russia's relationships with other countries and America's relationship, such as it is with Russia. First, kind of an interesting story. You had Russia issuing threats to Lithuania the other day. Now, Lithuania is a Baltic member of NATO, so Lithuania does have that security guarantee. A Russian attack on Lithuania is an attack on NATO. That would bring the United States into the conflict. Now, why is this happening? Why is Russia threatening reprisal attacks against Lithuania? It's because there's a Russian enclave called Kaliningrad that does not attach to Russia territorially, right? It's on the other side of Lithuania. It's nestled between Lithuania and Poland. It's this kind of bizarre Soviet-era relic where you had a city, Kaliningrad, that was somewhat repopulated by Russians in the post-World War II Stalin years, and Russia hung on to Kaliningrad on the back end of the Cold War. Now, what's happened is that in order to get supplies, like basic stuff, like concrete, the kinds of things that an enclave needs to survive and maintain its economy, a lot of that stuff flows through Ukraine on rail. And because of European Union sanctions, Lithuania is now saying they will not allow Russia to issue a lot of these shipments through Lithuanian territory. So the Russians have a problem. They can't get supplies to this enclave, this city, Kaliningrad, that's on the other side of Lithuania without going through Lithuanian railways. The Lithuanians are saying, you can't do that because of sanctions. And now you have Russia issuing threats to Lithuania that there's going to be some kind of response. The Lithuanians have pretty much taken this in stride. They've said that this is just more hyperbole from Russia. This is just bombast. They're not too worried about it. And they said, pointedly, they're not worried about it because they are a member of NATO. But it does bear watching, because one of the things you always want to look for in this war is any potential tripwire that could escalate the conflict directly between NATO and Russia. This is one of those places where it could happen. Although I tend to agree with the Lithuanians, we've seen the Russians threaten nuclear war over all kinds of things, including Finland and Sweden wanting to join NATO. This could just be more empty threats, empty bluster. Or we could see other kinds of Russian attacks on Lithuania. Cyber attacks, for instance, is something that they've used in the past against the Baltics. So something that bears watching. Today, in a surprise visit in Ukraine, the U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland has visited to offer support to some of the nascent efforts to hold Russia accountable for war crimes. The U.S. Justice Department obviously has a lot of expertise that can be brought to bear in these investigations to gather evidence, to build cases. So all in all, I think a useful visit and a sign that U.S.-Ukrainian cooperation extends far beyond just the military realm and the shipping of weapons. This is one other front in the area of cooperation, and one where I hope the United States can bring a lot of that expertise and a lot of those resources to bear in building what are very necessary efforts to hold Russia accountable for war crimes. At the same time, we've seen increasing reports about Americans who've been fighting in Ukraine. Now, Ukraine has a foreign legion that they've set up, and reportedly there are thousands of people who are not Ukrainian who are now fighting as a part of the Ukrainian military. And the U.S. State Department on Tuesday confirmed the death of an American citizen in Ukraine, and his obituary said that he died fighting in the war in May. His name is Steven Sibielski, and we don't know that much more about him. But we do know that it's the first confirmed death by the U.S. government of an American fighting in Ukraine. This guy was 52 years old and presumably was fighting as a part of that effort of foreigners going to Ukraine. We also have two Americans who had been captured and who are in Russian custody and don't seem to be offered the same kinds of protections that combatants would normally be offered in a war. The Kremlin's spokesman went out earlier this week and said that the two Americans who've been captured there will be, quote, held responsible for the crimes they have committed. And this suggests that the Kremlin might try to prosecute them as terrorists or as war criminals, and that would deliver them a much, much harsher sentence than if they're just being held essentially as prisoners of war. And we saw this happen earlier this month when a couple of Britons and a Moroccan who had been fighting with the Ukrainian armed services were actually sentenced to death in Russian-occupied territories. It remains to be seen what happens to these foreigners. But again, I think something to watch here is you have a lot of foreigners going to Ukraine to fight. They obviously bring expertise and experience that they've been serving in the American military and the British military. The Ukrainians see this as both a sign of international support, but also pretty practical support in that they're getting experienced soldiers on the ground. However, it's going to set up potentially more and more of these types of circumstances where you could have American casualties, British casualties, other national casualties inside of Ukraine, or you could have more of these kind of standoff trials where the Russians use the threat of really harsh sentences, life sentences, death sentences, to try to leverage or pressure or increase the cost for nations like the United States that are providing support for Ukraine. So this is something we have to watch. And I think the baseline point is that people who are fighting in this war should be treated as combatants. And that means that they should have all the protections of the Geneva Conventions, the kinds of protections that suggest that you hold prisoners of war, you hold them in appropriate conditions. You certainly don't sentence them in sham trials in the way that the Russians are doing. So once again, the Russians are kind of throwing out the playbook, and that's going to increase the danger to these individuals and obviously the despair potentially for their families, but also could become another, yet another source of geopolitical tension. One other area that bears watching, there are definitely signs that that Russian oil that has gone off the European market and the American market, because the U.S. has an oil embargo on Russia and Europe is weaning itself off Russian oil. There are definitely signs that China and India are making up some of the losses that Russia has suffered from sanctions. China's imports of Russian oil rose 28% in May from the previous month. That's a record high. And that means that Russia has actually overtaken Saudi Arabia as the largest supplier of oil to China. And this is one of the scenarios that we were watching when sanctions were announced. Was China going to essentially sit this out, buy the same amount of Russian oil that they always did, or might they try to step in? And one way they could help Russia out, certainly economically and in financing their war machine, is by buying more oil, maybe buying it at a discount rate. Initial signs are that China is doing that, and that some of these other Asian countries like India that rely somewhat on Russian oil are similarly ticking up their purchases of Russian energy. So this is something that raises questions for the United States. One question is, will we not just apply diplomatic pressure on countries like China, but will we start to sanction people that we believe are seeking to skirt the sanctions that have been put in place on Russia? And this is going to be a big challenge going forward. And one of the things that we've talked about to tie all this together is that as the fighting becomes this grind in eastern Ukraine, as it stretches out week after week, month after month, as inflation continues to be a huge political challenge inside of the United States and inside of Europe, will the sanctions regime start to break down? Will the Russians start to find workarounds? Will they start to exploit some of those political vulnerabilities around inflation in the West? A lot of those scenarios seem to be taking shape here. And so even though Ukrainians have been able to fight off the worst of the Russian invasion around Kyiv, they've not necessarily been able to push back the Russian offensive in the east. They certainly haven't been able to go on offense and take back significant amounts of territory from Russia. And there's now these other fronts in the war. There's a global food crisis. There's the holes potentially in the sanctions regime. And there's the political vulnerabilities in maintaining that sanctions regime because of inflation. So I think thus far, the Biden administration has been quite firm and demonstrated a lot of resolve, not just in imposing sanctions, but in holding NATO together and holding this sanctions regime together. As we enter this new phase, that's going to get more difficult, and it's probably going to require a sustained argument. And you don't hear much about Ukraine in the news, certainly to the same extent that you did a few months ago. In that environment, it's going to be more important, not less important, for not just people like President Zelensky of Ukraine, but for President Biden and other leaders of democracies to be out there reminding their publics what this fight is worth, why it's important to be plugging those holes in the sanctions regime and to be doing everything we can, obviously, to at the same time hold open a doorway to potential negotiation to put an end to the fighting. But so long as the Russian assault is ongoing, to get Ukraine the support it needs and to keep the pressure on Russia. So now, after the break, we'll hear my interview with Lena Volkov, who is Alexei Navalny's pretty longtime chief of staff. An interesting note, I taped this interview with Leonid in Copenhagen about a week ago. Since then, there's been some news about Navalny. He kind of went off the grid after we got accustomed to hearing from him, largely through social media. And you hear in the interview from Leonid how Navalny was able to tweet and post Instagram messages and essentially offer direction to his political organization from prison. Well, that circumstance is no longer available to them. And you hear Leonid, by the way, in the interview talk about how they expect that. And they anticipated that Navalny was going to be moved to a much more isolated and severe penal colony in Russia. That has happened since this interview. And so Navalny kind of went off the grid for a couple of days. Then it became known that he was moved to this more severe penal colony. You heard from people in the Navalny operation express their concerns here. We heard from Navalny's family saying, quote, "This is one of the most dangerous and famous high security prisons in Russia, known for torturing and murdering the inmates. It is, of course, very concerning because he is one-on-one with the same people and the same government that tried to kill him in 2020. So this is a pretty dire warning from Navalny's family and his associates that they're concerned for his well-being, his safety, and his life as he's been moved to this more, I guess in the U.S. parlance, it'd be more maximum security prisons, but in Russia, it's a bit even more severe here. And at a minimum, one of the outcomes of this transfer is that he's not going to be able to have the same degree of communication with his lawyers, with his political operation, and with the outside world that he's had to date. So yet another sign of Putin slamming the door on any voices of opposition from within Russia. Yet another challenge to Alexei Navalny, who's shown great courage. What you'll hear from Leonid, though, is that there is still a pretty substantial organization that Navalny's built that is active, that is based in Vilnius in Lithuania, another reason why Lithuania might be in Russia's crosshairs, and that is trying to carry on the work that Navalny set in motion, even if we may not be able to hear from Navalny in the same way that we have today. So stick around for the interview. It's really, really fascinating.
My name is Sarah, and I got involved with Vote Save America way back in 2018 when it first launched.
My name is Nancy, and I first got involved in VSA in 2018.
Ever since then, Vote Save America has been the best part of my political engagement. Anytime the election anxiety starts to feel overwhelming, I remind myself that my anxiety relief program donation is fueling grassroots organizations around the country.
And VSA has the Political Action Finder, a handy website I've used to find phone banks, knowing that I'm helping to win critical House seats.
In fact, I already signed up to volunteer with the Political Action Finder on the VSA website and helped replace disgraced former volleyball star George Santos.
So if you're someone who doesn't want to wake up on November 6th this year and regret not doing more, and I'm pretty sure you are, go to votesaveamerica.com to get started, and I'll see you at a phone bank soon.
This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com. And this ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
I'm very pleased to be joined by Leonid Volkov, who is the chief of staff for Alexei Navalny's political operation. And we're here in Copenhagen. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you for the invitation.
So let me just start by asking you, what is the condition of Alexei Navalny right now? And how much are you able to be in contact with him?
Well, he's imprisoned, which is a bad thing. But yeah. Otherwise, he's strong. I mean, he's mentally, morally, like, absolutely fit. We are able to maintain contact to him through his attorneys, who are allowed to visit him, like, on a regular basis. So they literally, like, print out the internet for him, so he is in touch with the reality, with the political reality, and he works a lot. So he's not only a symbol of the protest and resistance in Russia, but he also the acting head of our organization. organization. So he's not retired. He's not like just spending time there, but he's working and taking all the like strategical level decisions that define the operations of our political organization of the Russian opposition.
And how is his health? I mean, obviously he had been poisoned.
The absence of bad news is our good news in this regard. So you don't want to get sick in Russian prison. It's a place where there is just no healthcare in place. So when he got sick, like last April, it was a huge crisis. So really he had to go on a hunger strike to get medical treatment. Since that time, there was no other crisis. But if something happens, it will be a problem.
And he's, I think, scheduled to be moved to a more maximum security prison. He's been sentenced to an additional 15 years, is it? What are you anticipating there?
To additional 8 years. But, yeah.
Eight years additional.
Yeah,
okay.
And then there are new charges, which might add another 15 years.
Okay.
Yeah. But, I mean, first of all, no one cares. He doesn't care. We don't care about this charges and about his prison terms, because everyone knows his sentence was always meant to be life sentence.
Yeah,
but the question is whose life, his or Putin's?
Whatever
expires first. And of course, while Putin is in Kremlin, he will not allow Alexei to be released. And when Putin is gone, then Alexei will be released, we believe, quite immediately. Now, on the prison, that's a funny thing about Russian law enforcement, you know. It's according to the law.
Yeah.
He had to be moved to a maximum security prison a few weeks ago when his last sentence became effective. But it's Russian legal system.
Yeah.
For some reason, they don't do it. Maybe they didn't yet install all the cameras in the toilet and the new facility or something like this.
Yeah, they're preparing the new facility.
So they keep him in his current facility completely illegally, but no one cares.
Yeah. Well, and how is your... actually, I just one more question about this, because I was really struck when I talked to him for my book. He was totally lacking in fear. I mean, well, you know, he said you are afraid when you're in prison, but the certainty that he had about what he was willing to do and sacrifice. I mean, you've known him for a while. I think people look at this and just can't imagine that, you know, he would return to Russia from Germany after being poisoned and nearly killed. I mean, how do you, he's, you know, a colleague of yours, presumably a friend. What do you want people to know about why he does this and how he does it?
We worked together since like 11 years and we are close friends. But it is a question of perspective, actually. Like every time I'm doing an interview, journalists would ask me like, why did he return?
Yeah.
And I will say, I mean, why do you ask this question?
Yeah.
Like, how did he decide to return? There was never a decision point. There was never a situation when we were, like, I don't know, sitting at a round table and discussing, like, pros and contras.
Yeah.
Even since he was in a coma, we knew he will return, like, quite immediately because he belongs there, because he's a Russian political leader, because he didn't do anything wrong. He's, like, a free man. And because of all the sacrifices he's already taken. That's actually the point. So
His family supports him.
Yeah, he took enormous risks during like previous 12 years, like three trials in court, multiple arrests, like hundreds of days in detention, like a chemical acid attack against him in 2017 when he narrowly lost sight on his right eye, and the assassination attempt, everything, just to like stay abroad to become like a political exile would kind of make all the sacrifice of the past kind of like almost obsolete. It was like clear for him and for everyone around him, so we never had this discussion on whether he had to return. Of course he had to, and he has full support of his family and of the team. And of course we discussed a lot, like how the roles will be distributed, how we should work when he's imprisoned, like how the organization will operate and so on. And I'm pretty sure he is satisfied with how everything works. He's there in prison. but he's clearly the leader of Russian opposition. The perception of Russian politics is very clearly like black and white for everyone who observes it. It's like Putin versus Navalny.
Yeah.
And the organization is intact. Like, despite all the pressure against us, we were able to save it. It operates, and it operates on even larger scales than ever.
Yeah. Well, that's, so I want to ask you about that. So obviously, the combination of him being in prison, but also obviously the war in Ukraine must have transformed your operations. Just, we can get into the individual pieces of what you're doing, but how would you describe what the operation is doing now, where your focus is?
Yeah, indeed. Like, flexibility has always been the key to our survival in this very toxic environment. So we, our political organization did very different things during the last 10 years. We've been in electoral campaign when we were running like for mayor of Moscow or for president of Russia.
Yeah.
We've been a labor union when we organized like teachers and doctors to unionize when we helped them. We've been a political party when we tried to support our candidates in local regional elections. We've been, of course, a body of investigative journalism doing like anti-corruption investigation. And these are always the same people. So we are very like universal and flexible. So now, February 24th, we became the largest media operation in Russia. The largest Russian-speaking publishing house, so to say. Fun thing, Putin gave us a head start, actually.
Yeah.
So he forced us to move out of his country like last summer.
Yeah.
Like in April, they moved to announce us an extremist organization.
Yeah.
In June, we have been awarded this designation of an extremist organization. So after this, no one of our employees could stay within Russia. So otherwise, they would face like up to 10 years of imprisonment. So we relocated all our staff to Vilnius and elsewhere. And also, many journalists asked me, do you regret? And my answer was always, I don't have time to regret. Because we don't want to concentrate on the opportunities lost. We want to think about new opportunities. This yields us. And with our flexibility, we will be able to make use of these opportunities.
Like
when we were back in Moscow, we could never afford to run a wide-scale media operation because every third month, someone would come with a search warrant and would just seize all the equipment, pretending this to be like material evidence for yet another criminal case.
Yeah.
This happened to us like five or six times, like law enforcement raided our office in Moscow and took everything, like cameras, light equipment, laptops, phones, whatever. So we always operated like with a very small, basic set of equipment. In Vilnius, we don't have these constraints, so we announced that last summer we will build a huge media operation. And our plan was to launch a huge political entertainment YouTube channel on March 1st, 2022, like to reach out to new audiences through entertainment. Like literally to do like a cooking show, but to discuss like the enormously growing like food supplies prices during the, during the cooking show, something like this, like to connect to new audiences, to engage more Russian people into like political debate.
Yeah.
So we had to launch it March 1st. Now Putin invades Ukraine. The war starts February 24th. But we already have. We have our studio. We have our equipment. We have everything. Okay. We start to do like anti-war political television, like from the very first day of the war. We started on February 24th, and we continue for this 3.5 months with political news, news about the war, expert interviews, analysis, counter propaganda, like anti-fake and all kind of like dismantling Kremlin's propaganda, and so on, so on. Like we started with 2 hours of broadcasting a day. Now we up to like 6 hours of broadcasting a day. And I believe we will get to like 24 hours by the end of this year. It's like a real like political, independent political channel, which is the largest Russian independent media. We have a monthly reach of almost 20 million unique viewers, which is like, which is a huge operation. And we did it, the same people who did like anti-corruption investigations and the same people who did like local electoral campaigns now are doing in media. We hired a few professional journalists too, but still it's all such a like a makeshift operation. But we believe it's like very important because Putin not only started the war, he also silenced all the independent voices inside the country. But well, we are broadcasting on YouTube. We are able to push our message through. We believe it's very important because it's very important to change the attitude of Russian society to this war.
And is that 20 million? How much of that do you think is within Russia?
Almost all of them.
Almost all of it, yeah. And so what is your sense? I mean, there's some, you know, we see in the West this insane set of conspiracy theories and disinformation on Russian state television and online. You hear reports of, you know, 70-80% of Russians support this war, or you hear anecdotes of people in Ukraine calling their family in Russia and the people telling them, oh, we're there to fight the Nazis. Or what's your sense of Russian opinion? Because clearly, you know, not everybody agrees with the Putin line. You know, not everybody necessarily agrees with your line either. How do you have any grip on how Russians are thinking?
Well, Russian public opinion is, of course, something that it's now very challenging to measure. Yeah. So people just don't talk to the pollsters. So we have our in-house polling department within the Anti-Corruption Foundation. Since the Moscow mayoral election in 2013, we are always running the polls of our own because it's really important for our political operation to be aware of what's actually going on. And one fact that I can disclose, that the response rate for the telephone interviews for the surveys that we were routinely conducting was about 20% before the war, and it dropped to below 7% after the inception of the war. So people just don't talk to the pollsters.
Is that fear? Is that?
Yeah, that's fear. They feel fear. They feel stress. They don't want to confront the reality. They don't want to tell the truth and so on. So I dismiss those like claims that like 85% of Russians support the war. We don't see any public support. They tried, for instance, to introduce this like letter Z as a symbol of the support of the war. It appears only on, you know, like police cars and governmental institutions. People don't put it themselves like on their cars or phone covers or whatever. So it didn't take off. People like don't like this symbolic. And also, if we consider like for opinion leaders, like despite all the repression and the risks, like much more like singers, artists, scientists raised their voice against the war rather than supported the war. And also, if we ask questions like indirectly, if we run our polling in a more sophisticated way, then we are able to get closer to the truth. The last poll we did, we asked a question, imagine like oil prices are up. They are.
Yeah.
And there is additional income in Russian budget. So how would you spend it? Like now, we don't ask them to spend their money. Like in Ukraine, there is a 1.5% income tax for the support of the army since 2014.
Yeah.
For 8 years, Ukrainians are paying like additional 1.5% of their income for their army. And actually, we see the outcome. Ukrainian army of 2022 is so much different of Ukrainian army of 2014.
Yeah.
So if you would ask Russian people if they want to spend like 1.5% of their income, everyone would say no. But we ask this question, there is additional income in the budget. How would you like to spend it? Now, we have Russian citizens who are aware of the war, and propaganda is telling them every day, we are not only fighting those Ukrainian Nazis, we are fighting the NATO. We have enormous enemies. This is a third world war. The Russian culture is under pressure. They are going to destroy everything dear to every Russian. Those like those NATO American-led gays and lesbians are going to destroy our unique Russian civilization. So this is what propaganda is telling them 24/7. So what's your guess? How many of Russian compatriots wanted to increase military spending under this circumstances?
I guess like 40%?
6.8%.
6.8.
Less than 7%.
Yeah.
Wow. And it says a lot.
Yeah.
It says a lot.
Yeah.
So so you can't ask the question, do you support the war or not?
Yeah.
Because the person who's being asked knows perfectly that the wrong counselor yeah. must yield 15 years in prison.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
if you really like try to ask the question in a different way,
yeah.
the outcome is not that positive
different,
for Putin.
Yeah.
There is a core of hardline Putin supporters.
Yeah.
There are people who think Putin is not doing enough. So we have to like just drop a nuclear bomb
yeah.
on Kyiv, like to they are less than 10% by all measurements. The majority of people, the vast majority, unfortunately, are representing this political swamp.
Yeah.
People who don't follow politics, who don't follow the news, they are shocked by what is happening. They feel fear, and they kind of like use the cliches suggested by propaganda as their self-protection.
Yeah.
A regular person can't say to themselves, that's my fault. That's my guilt.
Yeah.
That this happened because I didn't ever participate in an election, because I didn't ever follow politics, because I decided to not to participate in political life. So
yeah.
I have my income, my vacations in Turkey, and my mortgage. So and let Putin handle everything.
Yeah.
Now this is my fault that Russia has become like a full-scale fascist state.
Yeah.
A regular person can't say it to themselves. It requires quite a level of reflection.
Yeah.
So not to get insane, like to protect their integrity.
Yeah.
They borrow these propaganda cliches. We had to do it, otherwise they would attack first.
Yeah.
We have to do it like to protect our culture from those Nazis and so on. But these cliches, this is not a bulletproof vest.
Yeah.
This is like a crunch and creme brulee.
Yeah.
So it's just a very basic protection, just not to think too much about what's actually happening. If we talk to them, if we just try to knock through this crust, we are able to change their opinion.
So how do you make people in that environment, especially when Putin's dominated so much of Russian politics for 20 years, how do you make them believe that things can change, you know?
Well, first of all, even the most hardline Putin supporters have to admit he's probably not eternal.
Yeah. Well, there's way it will end at some point. Yeah.
Well, probably some of them believe he is not.
Yeah.
He invests enormously in longevity.
Yeah.
As you know, his elder daughter, she's an endocrinologist.
Yeah.
And he has spent like billions on her institute where she effectively tries to develop a longevity pill.
But
hopefully she will not be successful. And Putinism is a very personal story. It's a real autocracy.
Yeah.
It's a real autocracy. It can't be inherited. Putin doesn't have a successor.
It's not a system. It's not like even the Soviet Union where you had a party infrastructure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just Putin himself and his lieutenants, each of them like hating each other. Even like when Stalin died.
Yeah.
It took them 3 years
to
come up with a new leader. Like first Khrushchev, Malenkov and Molotov killed Beria, then Khrushchev and Molotov get rid of Molotov, and then Khrushchev managed to dispose of Malenkov. It took them 3 years.
Yeah.
So pretty much the same gonna happen when Putin is gone. Like he has like 15 or 20 like key lieutenants, none of them being strong enough to take over. And this is on purpose. Putin doesn't allow any of them to get strong, because otherwise he will be considered the lame duck the moment he appoints a successor.
Yeah.
So Putin has his own like support, legitimacy, approval rating, popularity, but none of his lieutenants has.
Yeah.
And that's how the system works. They need him because only he can serve as a superior arbiter to resolve their conflicts and so on, because he has a mandate from the people. He used to have a mandate from the people. When he is gone, the names of majority of his like key people are not known to general public.
Yeah.
And none of them has like any significant resource. So there will be an enormous like fight of each other against each other,
yeah,
which will present a perfect window of opportunities for us.
Yeah.
Like, and we have invested like 10 years into building like horizontal structures, grassroots movements, training activists, and so on. We know we have millions of supporters inside the country, and we had an experience of like running protest rallies in 180 cities simultaneously. When there will be a window of opportunities, we will make the best possible use of it.
Looking from the outside, like I'm going to take a different category. So we'll start with tech because you're in media and you're a lot of your platforms you mentioned involve like YouTube. A lot of the American tech companies, you know, have kind of been pulling out of Russia. There's this difficult balance for tech companies. One is there's this movement for everybody to leave Russia, right? We're going to get rid of McDonald's and everything. But then again, the only way that people can get actual information about the war in Russia is if they can go on a tech platform like YouTube and see it. What do you think American tech companies can do to support people getting that information while not wanting to be a vehicle for Putin's propaganda?
Well, first of all, they have to talk to us. they have to talk, like, not only to us, to all independent media, to civil society. They have to understand better. So their previous strategy of just following, like, legal compliance and putting legal compliance ahead of human rights has clearly failed.
Yeah.
It is not a possible approach anymore. They have to think how to protect their users in countries like Russia or like China, Turkey, or Iran. They have to think about what's best to protect like human rights, like freedom of speech and so on. Like indeed, we are very dependent on tech platforms. Yeah, we operate mainly on YouTube. So the majority of our audience is on YouTube. And unfortunately, when the war started, like American tech giants did few mistakes, in my opinion, like severe mistakes. Like for instance, Google and Facebook switched off the opportunity, the option to run paid advertisement in Russia. They killed all monetization for Russian market. I believe they had a good intention, like not to let anyone earn money in Russia. But where did it lead us? Before the war, there were like four major platforms in Russia where you could do customer acquisition, like two domestic ones, like Yandex and VK, and then Google with YouTube and AdSense, and Facebook with Instagram.
Yeah.
So, and we did a lot of customer acquisition on Google and Facebook, while the government did customer acquisition everywhere. So they did spread their lies and disinformation and propaganda on all four platforms.
Yeah.
So we were able to compete. We had two platforms, they had four. Now they are down to two, but we are down to zero.
Yeah.
The government is still doing whatever they want with their disinformation on Yandex and VK, reaching pretty much every internet user in Russia. We don't have a tool to do customer acquisition exactly at the point of time when it's necessary. We talked about the political swamp.
Yeah.
People who didn't follow the news. But the war, this is such a dramatic and life-changing experience that actually many of them, for the first time, wanted to watch something, to read something, to make their own opinion, to understand what's going on. This was the perfect moment of time where we could catch them, where we could engage them, start talking to them. And we were not able to do it because we just can't run this annoying pre-roll on YouTube anymore for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And so we are growing. We are growing fast. But it's entirely organic.
People finding you. Yeah, it's not you being able to promote and find.
Exactly. It's only organic growth.
Yeah.
Could be much faster.
Yeah.
And of course, this growth for us and other independent media organizations on Russian language market, it's enormously important because it's one of the most suitable, it's one of the best possible tools to stop the war.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the First World War, 1914, like Russia and Germany, mothers and sisters and wives supporting their soldiers. You go, you fight for the God, for the Tsar, for the homeland. 1918, the same letters from home are, go back home. It's not your war. You don't belong there. You don't want to.
Yeah.
Both on Russian and German sides. And they just stopped fighting, effectively. Yeah. Army is part of society. The morale of the army depends on morale of the society, depends on attitude dramatically. So working with the public mood in Russia, we could affect the ability of Russian military to perform any kind of operations. It's enormously important. And we were stripped of this opportunity by Google and Facebook in a clear case of collateral damage.
Yeah. Well, that hopefully that can evolve over time. And then what about, sanctions policy has been a key way that the U.S. has tried to stop the capacity to maintain the war. What is your assessment of U.S. and Western sanctions, and is there more you think that could be effective?
Well, first of all, it's good they're finally there. We have been advocating for sanctions over assassination of Alexei Navalny, over other crimes of Russian government for a long time. And, well, if sanctions would have been adopted preemptively, this actually could have prevented the war, I believe.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. Because one of the reasons Putin decided to invade, he miscalculated in many regards. He miscalculated attitude of Ukrainian people, strength of Ukrainian army, but also Western response. Because of the history of past 8 years, he was sure there will be no response.
Yeah.
And actually, preemptive sanctions could have actually warned him. But, well, okay, the war has started. The West has responded strongly. But this has to be continued. There is one very easy test. Are sanctions enough or not? The war has stopped? No, then sanctions were not enough.
Yeah.
I'll teach you how to
do it. Yeah. Well, that's a good measure.
So, I mean, our next idea is this huge sanction list of 6,000 people, like the second tier people that we identified in the Anti-Corruption Foundation. These are like upper-level management of Putin's system, like deputy ministers, deputy governors, key members of propaganda outlets, board members of state-owned companies, and so on, so on, so on. Like people who endorsed the war, who made it possible, like real war enablers.
Yeah.
The most important fact about them is their average age is 45. This is the next generation. Putin's inner circle, they are Putin's age, and they have like nothing to lose, nowhere to run.
Yeah.
Their hands are covered in blood. Yeah. They know they were criminals and that's it. But to make the country run, to make the military run, to make the propaganda operate, they employ a huge layer of like next generation, hungry, agile managers.
Yeah.
Those managers have to be reminded that they will have a life after Putin because they're one generation younger. And now they can choose if this will be a life of war criminals wanted everywhere in the world or of people who made a very correct choice in the very last moment. So we are targeting them. We're doing it publicly. So not that we are talking, I don't know, like to European Commission, like behind closed doors. But we've published this list. We are promoting it in order to make these people scared, to make these people jump ship. Because Putin's propaganda and military machine can't run without those people. And if many of them escape, if he manage to like induce a domino effect, this will undermine Putin's ability to continue the war dramatically.
Well, one last question. I mean, what is, it can look like such a dark time, and obviously it's darkest of all for the people of Ukraine. But what sustains you? You clearly have a lot of energy. Do you have any hope, or is it just a kind of sense of obligation? Like, what motivates you?
Well, first of all, optimism is a job requirement.
Yeah.
You can't otherwise survive in Russian opposition. It doesn't work the other way. But of course, there is a lot of support from family and friends.
Yeah.
There is a lot of integrity. We know we're doing the right thing. We are on the right side of the history.
Yeah.
What we're doing is like morally, politically, historically, culturally right. We know that Russia belongs to Europe, that Russia deserves to be a decent European country, that Russian people deserve better. I live in Lithuania now, which shares the same history, which has been part of the communist empire for over 40 years, the houses look the same.
Yeah.
The people look the same. The buses, the everything. Like Vilnius looks pretty much the same as almost every Russian city of comparable size.
Yeah.
the same people and working a functioning democracy, competitive, fair elections, free press, parliament, and so on, it works. I know it works. Like, for the same people, it's the most like Russophobic idea
that it can't work
in the
in
world
Russia.
That it can't work in Russia. Of course it can. And also the other thing is that Lithuania doesn't have oil and gas,
yeah.
yet the average salary is just twice higher than almost two and a half times higher yeah. than in Russia. Like, because they don't have this enormous corruption burden, because they don't have Putin and his oligarchs and so on. Russians just deserve much better. And I clearly see how it's possible. And of course, the fact that we are also like one generation younger than Putin
yeah.
makes us sure that at the end of the day, we will prevail.
Yeah. Well, look, I really appreciate this chance to talk to you. People should watch the extraordinary documentary, Navalny, which we've talked about on this podcast before. How else can people kind of follow your work?
Yeah. Follow us on social media.
Yeah.
Go to our website. We now finally doing also an English language website. It's acf.international, so okay. Anti-Corruption Foundation. We have, by the way, our sanction list published there. We have a donate button there.
Yeah.
like
yeah.
we run on crowdfunding. And we see actually that some donations now arrive from our like English-speaking audience. So we have a Russian-speaking version of our website and the English version of the website, so we know who... I mean, how many people click the donate button on which version? We see that now, after the documentary, apparently,
yeah.
There is a lot of support from people who don't speak Russian but still want to support our work. That's okay. We publish there our news and new initiatives. And of course, you can subscribe to mine or Alexei Navalny's social media, where we also
yeah.
cover what's going on in the country. Thank you for this enormous opportunity to be on your podcast.
Great. It was great talking to you.
Pazzi of the World is a Crooked Media production. The executive producer is Michael Martinez. Our producer is Haley Muse. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to Saul Rubin for production support, and to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Phoebe Bradford, Milo Kim, and Amelia Montooth, who upload our episodes as videos at youtube.com/crookedmedia. In order to support our show, we need the help of some great advertisers. We want to make sure that those advertisers are ones you'll actually want to hear about. We need a little more about you to make that possible. So if you're willing, please go to podsurvey.com/podsavetheworld and take a quick anonymous survey that will help us get to know you better. That way we can bring on advertisers that you won't want to skip. Once you've completed the quick survey, you could enter for a chance to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Terms and conditions apply. Again, that's podsurvey.com/podsavetheworld. Thank you for your help.